everybody, and welcome to Bad End, episode 62, our first little string of special episodes we've got for you as we close this year out. We are doing something we don't normally do, which A, is releasing episodes kind of like more frequently, hopefully on a, more of a weekly cadence for this next stretch of a few weeks. But also we're doing something special where for these episodes, we're focusing on like basically the decade in games. And we're not just focusing on that for one episode. We're going to focus on it for a few episodes, but we're not just going to be the only ones talking about it. Each episode, we're going to have a special guest on the episode to talk about a specific aspect of the past decade in games. So as always, I'm joined with my two co-hosts, Josh Calixto and Katie McCarthy. But also for this episode and for our first Games of the Decade episode, I'm so happy to finally have on the podcast after too fucking long, honestly, Emily Rose of Rebind. Thanks for being on the podcast, Emily.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm so excited you're here.
I'm excited to be here.
And I just wanted to step in really quickly to also announce something exciting that we also have going on this month. We are actually launching something big. We've been talking about this for the past few weeks, but essentially what's happening is we are launching a new network of websites / podcasts called Superculture. And Superculture is going to have a few different things under its wing. We've got Bad End, of course. We have Bullet Points, which is both a podcast and a website. And now we have the Superculture Review, which is a new podcast we launched actually yesterday, which is going to be focused this first season on Disco Elysium. So we've got that podcast that just launched. It's called Savoir Faire, a Disco Elysium podcast. That is all under one big umbrella. So that's going to grow over time. We are still figuring out exactly what it all entails, but we are all operating, you know, as partners. We're helping each other out, and we're trying to make some good journalism, some good podcasts, some good content for everyone out there under the umbrella theme of, you know, giving coverage and observation of things that are currently typically under observed. So that is what that is. But without further ado, let's get started talking about this decade in video games. Emily, why don't you first off introduce yourself? And I guess your sort of space in the video game / indie realm right now.
Sure. So I'm the founder of Rebind.io, which is a art house, curative, critical analysis outlet. We saw that there was a gap specifically in coverage and teardowns when it comes to really small indie games, what we've kind of like coined as like micro indies, you know, which is generally less than like five people, but it's also kind of a measurement of clout. We look for the stuff that people haven't heard of, mostly because there's just a lot of really good stuff out there. So we've been expanding this year into a couple of different things. We've been in pre-production for a video series that we're going to be doing on YouTube where we interview local developers right now just because it's what's in our budget and range. But we've had developers like pass through the area through international travel and stuff like that. So it's not restricted just to the Pacific Northwest. Then on top of that, like we've just been kind of trying to figure out different ways we can branch out and expand the coverage because a lot of what we do is in support of the community. We're not ad supported, we're user supported. So our readership puts in the money that they want to see into our site, and we kind of just cover things accordingly to what we see fit to do so with.
Great. And how did you sort of get started in video games and in the indie space in particular? Is this a funny story?
Oh, yeah. No, this is a very complicated story. I'll give like the short version. I kind of have just been modding since like I was a kid. You know, it was just really fun to like tamper with games. And eventually I migrated over to like Half-Life Source Engine kind of stuff. Did a few things there, got really deep in the level design, and then level design temporarily kind of died out as a career. And so I sort of retreated from the idea of doing anything like game-wise professionally because I didn't really want to learn 3D software suites or anything like that, which was the direction that everything was going, like really heavy to environmental art. Now it's come back to level design again in the old school sense, which is funny because now I'm a 3D artist, although I'm like kind of moving towards business development stuff. But specifically with media coverage and things like that, it sort of just came about through the idea that I used to read stuff like Rock, Paper, Shotgun every day, just because it was a way of like kind of keeping my pulse on what was new and interesting. And I really enjoyed the like sort of bespoke style that they had. It wasn't just like, oh, I give it a 10 out of 10 or whatever. It was something like thoughtful and introspective and meditative. And then that just kind of stopped at some point. I can't really put my finger on when. Maybe it was the buyout that they went through a few years back, and like kind of all the wonderful like critical discourse outlets that we had sort of took a decline about probably the middle of the decade or so. And so after so many years of just being without that, and starting to, you know, I've always been fond of really small games, like Game Jolt, Itch, anything like that. So I had already been starting to pick those back up and go through them and kind of like reach out there and look for more experimental things outside of my traditional library. And I wound up stumbling down this rabbit hole and realizing that there were some pretty incredible games, both on Steam, Itch, and beyond, that were just not getting talked about. Not even remotely recognized. Some of my favorite Itch games, I'd go and look at the Twitter accounts for the people that had made them, and it was like literally like, I don't know, like 30 followers. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. Like, why is there not more coverage for this stuff? And why do we continue to talk about like horses, balls, and Red Dead Redemption? You know, it just like really, it felt criminal to me. And having come from a taste-making background in other different commodity sectors. You know, I've spent a lot of time in like food. And so it seemed like there were some lessons to pull on in terms of how those industries branded their specialty products and bring a little bit of that over to games. Because I felt like it kind of has, especially indie games, have like an image problem. So a lot of people tend to look towards film, but I actually look towards commodities because I think there's a lot to learn there.
It's so funny because we had, I guess it's two or three episodes ago, we had Soleil Ho on the podcast. She's a food writer for the San Francisco Chronicle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chronicle.
Is that right? Yeah. And she was like, she was just talking to us about food journalism and we were just like freaking out because it's like, this just sounds 100% like games. And like nearly every aspect of the discussion about like where certain food gets like food types or styles get pushed to the margins versus like mainstream food and how like non-mainstream-esque food stuff gets covered. I mean, I think that's one thing you're kind of speaking to too, is something that I think is really, I feel like we talked about it. Bad End's been around now for two and a half years. I remember like when we were starting, like, so we all came from Killscreen and Killscreen kind of, you know, pittered out in terms of what it used to do. And even when we started Bad End, that was still a while after that. And then I remember us talking and just being like, it just seems like this, all this stuff is just being left on the floor with like all this stuff that's happening on Itch that like no one is looking at. It's like, that's just like, and that's not, I mean, it's not money on the ground, right? Like if it paid money to cover that stuff, it'd be a different sort of story. But like, I think specifically it was that all these things are coming out and no one is talking about it.
And
go ahead, Josh.
I feel like we're in like the indie game coverage post-apocalypse right now. We're like, not to say that indie game coverage has disappeared or whatever. I'm just saying, as far as like the amount of space it takes up in the conversation, I felt like there was a lot more places to go earlier on in the decade that have just fizzled out. Like Kyle said, that are in the process of fizzling out. And it feels like there's almost, it's not even like taking a last stand. It's like trying to rebuild or figure out like what's next for coverage of indie games. And I don't know. And I still don't know what that is. I think it's kind of scary to think about in some ways, because it's like, this space is once again wide open, and how do you kind of enter into that space? You know, what are your thoughts on that?
Honestly, extremely optimistic. I am, despite being a deeply cynical person at times, I am so wildly excited about what's going on. And kind of bring it back to food journalism for 2 seconds. I highly encourage anyone who's interested in how we approach games media to pick up a copy of like Barista Magazine, of all things. If you find one in like a local specialty coffee shop and flip through it, and you will see the parallels just like bleeding through the page. Like, it is absolutely astounding to me. They talk about the same ways and the same thing. I mean, like, we kind of have our like saucy little outlets that talk about things in these very like, you know, down to earth, like I'm in your living room sort of way, a little bit of snark. And if you go and read something like Sprudge, it's the same thing, you know, it's the industry rag, right? You know, where they kind of take the piss out of the status quo, but also like raise some interesting issues with stuff. And when it comes to what we've dealt with right now in terms of reconstruction, I think it's interesting because I feel like a lot of games crit at the start of the decade was very much so born out of like, you know, we have all these games. We're in sort of like at that time, I guess what I would refer to crudely as like an age of decadence, right? We just have too many games on Steam flooding in, and everybody has money to throw around, and everything's affordable, and everybody's doing their little like indie gold rush, you know, this indie game, the movie stuff. And there was this idea that like, wait, shit, this is really culturally important. We need to rush to build academic models for game studies, and we need to do it like pronto. And so there was this idea of like, new games journalism had just come to the forefront over the past few years with stuff like Rock, Paper, Shotgun, and then spreading out to other outlets from there. There were several new outlets founded in that time span. And then on top of it, people realized that like, oh, formalism is important. You know, we need to be respectable. You know, there was a lot of weird respectability politics involved with that era, because especially coming off the heels of the whole, like, what was it, the Roger Ebert thing, where it was like, our game's art. And the weird kind of cargo culting around terms like ludonarrative dissonance. It kind of became this situation of good attempt, but inevitable collapse. And I think between the public perception of games media and the internal, you know, there was a big media bubble that went out with when those Facebook video analytics originally came out, that shifted all the publishing scope from like written word to video. A bunch of people lost their jobs. So it's like, it's hard to keep up things in that climate. And now I think at the end of the decade, we're sort of in this place where we're like, okay, the Facebook analytics are bullshit. Trend chasing doesn't always work out or is not necessarily profitable. And something that you mentioned is like, yes, there's not exactly money laying on the floor, but I think we are in an era of recognizing that you kind of have to make your market. People are desensitized. They're hypersaturated with everything. You know, there's just, we are once again back in a period of there's just too much shit to play, to read, to watch. And I think what people want more than anything at this point, instead of gimmicks, is they just want clear-cut, solid analysis and opinions to tell them what is relevant to their taste rather than what is the most value. Because it's not hard to buy games now. It's not hard to get them through different alternate means. But what it is hard is to know what is relevant to my very niche tastes. What is relevant to my sensibilities? And that's why I think we're seeing games media diversify quite a bit, past just, again, the rote standard coverage and even past the new games journalism. I've kind of jokingly referred to this period. I couple weeks back on Twitter, I just opened up a Google Drawing document. I was like, all right, guys,
oh my God.
we're gonna do a taxonomy of games journalism.
We have to post that. If we haven't posted that, have you guys seen this?
Yeah, yeah. I didn't realize that was you.
Yeah.
I forgot about that. That was so amazing.
Yeah. It was kind of a little bit trolling because I kind of just wanted to like, back in coffee, you know, we talked about everything as like, oh, we're in third wave coffee, right? That was a big like, ooh. And so I'm like, okay, if like new games journalism is like third wave games media, then we're in the fourth wave. Because I just like kind of like throwing stupid terminology on things like that. But I think words are important. I think they're important in creating sex appeal for these things and mm-hmm. to make it appealing to the consumer market, because for them, they want to feel cool when they buy things. They want to feel like they're in the know. And perhaps it's a little my cynical business dev side talking, but it works. And if that is in service of making it sustainable for these small artists, more power to it. You know, I'll play every trick in the book at that point.
Yeah. I wanted to go back a little bit. This is kind of like a Q&A type thing so far, but I just, you're saying so much stuff that I'm like, I want to go through all of it. But earlier you had mentioned that indie games had like an image problem. And I'm curious if you could unpack that a little bit, but also if you think that there was something similar with going on with indie game publications at all, if maybe there was some parallels there.
Ooh, that's a good one. Okay. I feel bad just like kind of going on tangent, but I have a lot to say. Indies have an image problem for a couple of reasons. Part of it is a self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm going to be honest. We have a huge issue when it comes to game media. We are not proactive. And I think part of that comes from the old guard attitude of like, your press structure is this. People email you. You maybe respond. You probably don't. You probably just write a piece eventually after getting it approved by your editor. It shows up on the website. So, you know, for indies, it really feels like a gotcha game. You know, they put in the coin and they hope something happens, and it might not happen. But if it does, it could potentially have huge ramifications to them. So they keep doing it.
I do want to cut you off real fast, even though it's probably bad to do. Katie's like shaking her head a lot.
What?
And Katie, you're the only person. You're just like agreeing. You're like, yeah. And I would love to hear like kind of your side of that too. Cause like you're one of the few people from us that like works inside of like, I mean, the closest thing that we have to like Bigs Games journalism, like, I've watched like especially you specifically kind of the way you approach indie stuff on US Gamer has kind of shifted. Like I'm interested from like the publication side. How does that kind of square with your understanding? Not to say that like you're under fire as like big journalism or something, but like as someone like you who traditionally champions indie games on a site that is not like known for its indie game coverage, I'd love to know like how you approach that as well.
When I first started, I used to have like a column where I would like spotlight random stuff I'd find on Itch, and we ended up like killing it because it didn't do like any traffic, and it was kind of like a, not like a waste of time, that's a bad way to put it, but you know, it's like, oh, like your time can be better spent. But how I also see it is my team is very, very small compared to most gaming outlets. Like we're 9 people in total, but that's 5 editorially in like America, and then we have like a few people in the UK that do like guides and SEO stuff. So I like how I see it is like a lot of these bigger outlets like IGN, GameSpot, Polygon, these like teams that have like dozens and dozens of people, like I feel like they don't have an excuse not to cover smaller games and like be like a curator. Like
Rewind is like 4 people. It's 4 people.
Yeah, like it might like that feels like a rude call out, but also it's like my excuse is I literally do too much in a given day. I don't have, like, we can barely keep up with just, like, the big games that are out. And we just cover, like, them. Indie stuff. Like, yeah, exactly. And, like, we, like, have our, like, passion games. Like, we cover Disco Elysium quite a bit. Like, we have the game, like, we try to focus on games where we're, like, this needs coverage and we're going to give it coverage. But it's so hard for us as a team because we're so small, all as is. It's, like, hard for us to manage it. But I feel like a lot of these like bigger outlets, it's like, I don't understand why they don't do more because they have the manpower for it. Like they don't, it's just very strange, but maybe that's just me. I have always worked in small editorial teams. So I'm used to like being stretched thin and having to make priorities and make hard decisions of like, oh, what is like the more important game to cover this week? But with these like bigger outlets, I'm like, why don't you just have like one person doing a column each week? Or why don't you just have like someone keeping an eye on Itch, like not just like the fresh games tab, but like digging through like the recent tab and seeing like what is something that's not getting attention. And like I try to do that when I can, but I just frankly don't have time. And I pass it along to like our news people. I'm like, this seems kind of cool if we want to like cover it. And usually it's like, no, these other news things take priority, which is just like an honest thing of my job because we have two news writers of like for a whole website. But yeah, I don't know. It's definitely like a weird thing where I wish I had the bandwidth to cover more indie games, but the truth of it is usually it's like I can do a review and that's like it. And that's like pretty sad. Or maybe an interview and that's it. Like it depends. Like Eliza, I hit pretty hard over the summer. I just a lot of coverage of that when no one else really was, but that's like not even like that small because it's Zachtronics. But
yeah, I mean, I think I was something just to, I mean, I get back to you in like 1 second, but I remember this and this is a tie here. I remember someone was on some Slack or Discord and there was someone who writes for like a lot of big publications and they were like, it's honestly really hard often to write about Itch now because Rebind is always just getting all the good shit. It's like, I think that kind of that, I think what's, I mean, even like to your point, Katie, it's like, it's crazy to me that some of these bigger outlets aren't just like basically stealing what Rebind is discovering and just even boosting it at all. It's that like, I feel like Rebind is just, it's like, they're just posting on stuff. It's like, there's the itch.io like fresh tab, but there's also just like the stuff that's popping up on Rebind. But what's crazy is I'm not seeing like the sort of percolating. It's that like it exists on Rebind and that's like enough for people. And it's like, I mean, Rebind is great, but it's like it doesn't have the readership of like IGN. So like signal boosting any sort of micro indie would be like game changing for some of them, but it just like doesn't happen.
There was like a little bit when Chloe was still at IGN, Chloe Rad, she had like a column.
That's true.
Like a monthly column for stuff. And that was really cool. And then it just like disappeared randomly. And I think she like tweeted that it just got cut for like traffic reasons. And I think that's like also, I mean, I'm sure there are, I was being a little unfair to bigger outlets earlier, but I feel like it is also like, you know, because they're more corporation, they feel more like corporations than maybe US Gamer does, but like they are maybe more beholden to like what gets traffic. So it's like, people are like, no, we need like the 50th article on Death Stranding, not whatever you found that's cool, like roguelike you found or whatever. Like I'm sure it's like a way harder sell because a lot of the like top people at bigger outlets probably just see money and like numbers and that's it, and don't see the value in like curating and like spotlighting developers that don't normally get spotlight.
Yeah. And so you were talking about specifically like in light of all this stuff that like bigger publications to indie games could often feel like gotcha games, where it's like just kind of rolling the dice and hoping that like the person whose column you're pitching like doesn't get killed, or like that the person who you want to cover your game is the one person that like understands like micro horror or something. Like, so that's where you left off. I don't know if you keep going from that kind of line of thinking.
There's a couple of things I wanted to tie together there too that you had just brought up, because when it comes to the larger outlets, I don't understand why they don't just sort of rely on a syndication model. Like newspapers learned this really on, was like, we don't need to have all these multiple culture pieces. We can just find like the culture piece and sort of like just like signal boost that along the way. And if they're having such a problem making that profitable, I think working out a syndication deal across multiple websites would be a good idea to solve this situation, because it seems like you're right. Every time,
that's a really good idea.
I haven't even thought of that, to be honest with you.
Rebind is available for syndication for anyone listening. But it's like all these outlets keep trying to contract or have these in-house little columns, and it's part of the issue is that those big corporate outlets, you wouldn't put on a ballet show at a truck stop, right? And I think that make your audience has always been the operating principle, and that the audiences that have been cultivated over the years by these major outlets, especially the big boys like IGN, et cetera, things like that, they've kind of painted themselves into a corner. You know, they can't really change their coverage model because they have a bunch of people that expect it. I think back to a Twitter thread that occurred when John Walker ran a poll he had sort of asked his audience, hey, if I started an independently run indie column that was done with Patreon, would you subscribe to that? Would you pay into it? And I don't remember what the final results were, but pretty close towards the end there, it was like 70% said no. And if you just go through the thread, there's just a bunch of people going like, I love your writing, I love indie games or whatever, but I just can't, I don't care. I can't justify it, or like, not right now, or like, you know, I've already got other things I'm spending money on. Which is funny because you come over to our corner of the internet where we have a completely different audience, I feel like, a less traditional user base, and people are really ecstatic and thrilled to throw money at this. I've been kind of astounded with our Patreon growth. Like, it could still absolutely be more because this is very much so a full-time gig for the four of us. But it's this idea that like there are people who are willing to be patrons of the arts. And then there are people who, again, just look at video games as like a commodity thing. And for them, like indie games, especially micro indies, just sort of feel like a bonus. You know, for them, it's like a making of featurette on a DVD. They don't really have that much investment in it. Whereas you have like developers, you know, these fans of the fine arts, performance arts, things like that, and other creators in different industries. And they're like super excited to like get in on this. So to kind of take it back to where I started, when it comes to answering your question about image, I think about that a lot of our work is trying to sort of reverse engineer the precedents that have been set for the past 10 years or more with games media and figure out how do we make art house stuff more appealing to the commodities market? Not because I want to capture that entire user base and not because I think it would necessarily be healthy to do so, but where can we get sort of those center demographics, those people who would be more receptive to like performance artsy stuff or like things that are more insightful and thoughtful? Like, I guess to put it this way, it was pretty universally well received when Drive came out, and Nicholas Winding Refn is very much so a super art house director who makes really weird films, but people like Drive, and Drive by action movie standards was pretty artsy. So I want to find those people and I want to connect them with the artsy stuff that they feel is still like relatable. And then maybe that can sort of be a gateway drug into like their like really weird stuff. Because I feel once there's a demand for it, it will become more sustainable. I have a couple of different ideas of how to approach that, but I hope this kind of answers the question for you a little bit.
Yeah, I want to, to that note, one thing that happened this decade was that Twitch became a thing, that like YouTube Let's Plays blew up. And I feel like we had a lot of indies that came into the spotlight using that as a kind of vehicle. And I mean, it was interesting. I think we had talked about this when Getting Over It came out with Bennett Foddy. That got huge traction on Twitch. I would watch the League of Legends streamers that I watch would play that while they were waiting in queue for their next game. People would play all types of video games like that. And we talked about like this kind of Twitch worthiness of these games. And I think that's something that's like, you know, that's going to get even bigger, but I'm curious as to like how, you know, how you see that, how Rebind might see something like that and how that factors into the whole equation too.
Boy, oh boy, do I have things to say about that.
Good. I'm like, honestly, Emily, like there's three of us on this show and we talk about a lot of different subject matter, but you know, sometimes we'll come back to the same ideas because we're three people and like we get new ideas on a, you know, a moment to moment basis. But I feel like you're just throwing all this stuff at me that I'm like, the syndication thing. I was like, what is this?
Josh was like, hold the fucking phone. Baden's becoming a website.
I'm like, I gotta write this down for my meeting.
I don't know how that thought didn't pop into my brain before. It's nuts.
It's copyrighted and patented. Just, you gotta, Creative Commons license. You gotta cite me.
Okay. All right. We won't steal that one.
The big thing with me for influencers is that I kind of think that, like, we're in an era of, like, too many billionaires, right? And I kind of feel like we're also in an era of too many social capital billionaires. I look at it from the perspective of like the mileage you get. And there was a big kerfluffle about this like a couple days ago with like Vine Sauce and like whether or not, you know, being featured on a huge influencer was like relevant to your audience and actually promoted sales. And it's like, I've noticed this on Twitter too. It's like, I can get a campaign or something I'm trying to get out there retweeted by someone with like maybe a couple thousand followers and get like really, really good engagement. And then I could have someone like Patrick Klepek like throw out an RT and I get zip. I get zero, even though he has such a huge audience base and like algorithmically and by the metrics that should yield really good results. And it just doesn't. And it's kind of the same thing with YouTube. It's like Vine Sauce can play your game. And if his audience isn't into the idea of these small games, they're not going to seek it out. They're not there for the games. They're there for Vine Sauce. They're there for whoever their favorite is. And that's why I think it's really important to sort of look to video essays. We have like Umbrella Terms, Errant Signal. And then we've got a couple of other small ones like Soft and Hollow and things like that. And the thing about them is that the audience that they have spent all this time cultivating is the kind of people who are going to go be patrons. And so I think that this idea that the gigantic like influencer pyramid, it almost very much so seems like an unintentional like Ponzi scheme. You know, like, oh, if I just get all my friends to link this to PewDiePie, I'll get rich. And we're all at the bottom of some kind of pyramid, right? And I feel like streamers are just as much of a part of that pyramid too. And I think that kind of has an unhealthy effect downstream. You know, I think about like back when, this is going to sound wild, back when Chicago was full of slaughterhouses that just dumped everything into the river, you had this massive health crisis because of like viscera washing up on shore and just flooding the sewers and just all this horrible catastrophic offense until they just went like, all right, enough is enough. We need like a proper sewer system. We need to figure this out to get rid of all this like blood and guts and gore and viscera. And so we're kind of having the same problem when it comes to like the news sphere. Like the news sphere is getting polluted. The zeitgeist is like toxic. Like, what are we going to do about it? And part of that is recognizing that we have certain responsibilities when it comes to stewardship and that we can't just expect bigger is better, quantity over quality. It's like, again, our spectrum of coverage is getting more narrow and focused and specialized because we've gotten all the broad stuff out of the way. Like, people have had the broad coverage for like 20 years and the libraries have just grown so massive. And so this also needs to be reflected in how people reach out to influencers. You know, you need to be more surgical about who you're approaching. And make sure you're going like, am I going to the right streamers? Am I going to the right influencers? And we're seeing all these like people crop up in specialized roles at companies being like, this is our guy that talks to all the streamers because I don't know how to go on Twitch because I'm a busy CEO. You know, I had to hire a guy to like go on Twitter and talk to YouTubers, which is on the face of it such a ridiculously absurd thing. But I still think it's relevant. Like, I like to talk about the idea that part of the reason we don't do ads on Rebind, there's a couple of reasons. One, I don't think ads are ethical, frankly. I'm a bit of a digital utopianist in that regard. I remember a time in the internet where we just didn't have ads and we had free-flowing knowledge and it was great. But that sort of like crazy socialism aside, it's very much so that it doesn't make sense to have ads because we don't care about page views. We don't care about clicks. The way our model works is that we rely on reaching and writing specifically for the people that exist at the top of that influencing pyramid. Developers, other journalists writing for major news sites, streamers, those sorts of people come to us because they want something fresh or they want to be able to read the things that they can't write at their sites because they can't convince their boss to do it. Because we all have that itch we needed to scratch. You know, we all at one point read Rock, Paper, Shotgun. And now that sort of stuff is gone, we've been able to fill that niche pretty well. But we're not the only site doing that, right? We've got the Capsule Crit. We've got Into the Spine. We've got, who else? I just listed off a bunch today. John Walker just launched his own one, coming back to video games. And then let's see, what else we've got?
For the 30%.
Yeah, we got Deep Hell, which is a really interesting one that's almost kind of in the vein of like Tim Rogers' old writing on like actionbutton.net. Very like critical stuff of the industry, very like punching up, like it's great. Then we also have, there's like Uppercut, which I'm not as familiar with, but I've been like keeping in touch with them and they're pretty chill. And then No Escape VG, who I was just on their podcast like last week or so talking about the new Half-Life VR game. And so I guess to just like sort of bring this all home, like that image problem with games very much so ties in again with the established model, with the cultivated audiences. And if I were to bring this all back home, I'd say the best way we could do that is talking about the term micro-indie, which sort of sounds so insufferable every time it escapes my lips. But people have seemed to enjoy the term thus far, and it's been useful. I gotta ask, since we haven't had this conversation yet, how do you all respectively feel about the term micro-indie? Like, what does that bring in your head?
I feel like I use the term like alt games, which also, I feel like that sounds even more pretentious than micro-indies. Like micro-indies, I feel like brings up a very particular type of game in mind of just like, oh, just the cool, like under an hour experiences I play on itch or whatever. Whereas I feel like alt games just implies that everything has to be like alternative in like a weird way, which is like not necessarily every game.
And I know that alt games specifically has a lot of baggage for the sort of games crit blogging sphere of like 2013 and so that's like a really, and that term's like still kind of radioactive, which is why I tried, because initially I felt the same thing. I was like, oh, what are these like alt games, like what do I call these? And it's like, if you call something indie, it's like, the hell does that mean? Like, yeah. is it like Radiohead indie or like what's going on? But no, I'm interested to see what the other two of you think as well.
No, I had a similar idea as Katie. I think it's like, it has a very specific image. I think of like itch and smaller platforms. It also comes across to me as something that might have to do with like resources and size of like the companies that produce these games and how much is behind them, because a lot of the games that you do see on Twitch are like sketches almost, or like vignettes, quick ideas that someone is putting down on the page that become largely influential because someone sees it and is like, wow, this is a great idea, I want to turn this into a full game, that type of thing. It also brings to mind like microbreweries and stuff like that.
you did it Yeah, you figured it out.
Yes. And I think that's like it's a great parallel to draw, just because I think of breweries and that whole scene right now. And I live in Southern California, where it's really blown up in the past couple of years. Like a lot of my family is really into going to breweries. They have these great little spaces that have distinguished themselves, that I think has been a really, really good for them. They're able to sustain themselves because they have their own vibes, their own ideas. And, it's a cool parallel to draw, and it's like sort of aspirational in the way that like I can see an almost working example in like the brewery and beer scene.
So I want to get Kyle's thoughts too, but I'm so glad you picked up on that, because that is very intentionally engineered into the term. Like I kind of sat there like I have some hobbies in terms of like ontology and like memetics and things like that, and thinking about like how we cognitively approach ideas and semiotics. And I think I had this like sort of mad scientist moment of like, what if I just like engineered artificial terms and just let them out in the wild? Like, here's this glowing radioactive,
I mean, like, what if you made language happen?
Running around. Yeah, exactly. Like I'm going to put this like flying rabbit out and see what happens to the ecosystem. But I'm glad that comes through, because I think, again, that's really important to have that like bespoke artisan element to it to help kind of fix the image. And it also sort of like narrows the scope of it. Like you were saying, it relates to this vague idea of like something to do with resources. And it's great because that term is layered in such a way that it escapes having a finite definition, but it still brings the scope down to a reasonable level where people can have multiple interpretations of it, but it's generally going to retain the same amount of practical value with either any of those interpretations. Mm-hmm. So I wanted your thoughts though as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's a really great term. I don't know if my other two co-hosts agree with me, but I definitely feel like the word indie is just like, it doesn't really mean anything right now.
It's a crater. It's an ontological crater.
It doesn't mean anything. Yeah. Like everyone is kind of indie in their own way. Like I think it really, really broke for me. I mean, it broke a long time ago, but then I think it really broke again when I read, I think I've even cited this in the podcast before, but when Ars Technica did that piece on Lucas Pope and making Obra Dinn, and like, love Lucas Pope's a great dude, like his games are great, but like he used to work at like Naughty Dog and he was a tools programmer on Uncharted and has like a ton of skill and like made a lot of money doing Papers, Please, and like is, I don't know how well Obra Dinn did, but like his level of skill, or like someone like Jonathan Blow or something that like was like an engine programmer and is now making their game based off like other success, or is like that, like to the idea that those people are indie in the same way that like someone who's 2 years into their game design program is indie is like, doesn't make sense to me. Whereas like micro indie is a term. Oh, and sorry, one more thing before I talk about micro indie, like having done a lot more conferences in the past 2 years for video games, like, and having like pitched as a developer to publishers at those conferences, like the people I'm pitching to are like indie publishers, but they're like most everyone there. Like, I don't see publishers there besides like the biggest big publishers that like exclusively publish games made by like Blizzard or Activision or whatever. I guess it's Activision Blizzard, but there's basically AAA publishing, which essentially publishes a very small set of games. And then there's like kind of indie publishing. Like, it didn't work out, but like I pitched my game to Calypso. That's like a pretty big strategy games publisher that publishes like Tropico and other stuff like mm-hmm. that. And like, they heard my pitch. I'm like an indie developer that was pitching this like quote unquote non-indie publisher, but they're looking for stuff like what I do. And so I've just felt like being indie is like, I don't even feel like I'm indie in a way, in the way that I think indie is supposed to be. But I know that I'm definitely not micro indie, because I can say, I feel like because Katie was saying, micro indie itself actually feels like a designation, whereas indie just feels like it's kind of, I mean, in the same way that I feel like the journalism coverage has sort of flipped, has just kind of like dispersed itself, or basically there's clearly AAA and then just everything else is indie, but that's not really true, because indie doesn't mean, I mean, you mentioned like AA or like III is also a thing, but specifically micro indie feels like a much better term to describe the bulk of what I think people would typically call indie these days. But micro indie itself is like, that's clearly a thing. There's like platforms, there's modes of distribution. There's things that you can attach to what it means to be micro indie in a way that I think you can't really do anymore for indie. So I think it's a great term.
So the interesting thing that I've noticed about the vernacular in general, but especially when it comes to these like terms of power, as it were, is that they have a gravitational pull to them that can affect the meaning of adjacent words. And you just kind of demonstrated that with like, oh, by having micro indie in the space and by having a term like AA, it kind of brings everything into that into more of a stable orbit. And like you were saying, like, because you have this know-how, these connections and the kind of publishers you're approaching, you can still feel comfortable calling yourself indie and knowing what that means and knowing how that fits in the greater ecosystem, because we have these more defined boundaries of like the different scopes of the spectrum. And I think that's sort of an interesting side effect of that. I had something to mention as well, because I think Katie brought this up, of there are companies like Zachtronics, right? It's like, how do you classify them? Because, you know, I've met Matthew Seiji, we hang out a little bit, and you never get the vibe that like he or anyone else at Zachtronics is a big deal, right? Because it's like, I remember, I think we were one of the first outlets to cover Eliza at least at length. You know, some other people have maybe done some like press releasey stuff. That's another problem I have with some of the coverage out there for indie games. It's like sometimes it's just like press release, copy paste, and like that's okay. I get it. We have a lot of freelancers right now, and when you're a freelancer in like games press, you're writing like 5 pieces a day for 5 different websites, and it's like you're just stretched so thin. I get it. I never want to seem like I'm being challenging towards individual people, because I recognize that like it's the system inflicting that on them. So I'm very careful in that. Like I look and criticize the institutions. I'm very particular in how I punch up. When it comes to it, it's like Eliza, we were one of the first people to cover it at length and depth. That's kind of like why we've expanded our coverage a little bit from Mike Randy's into like some AA and even the occasional like contemporary AAA stuff. Like we did a piece on The Outer Worlds. We did a piece on Death Stranding. But we make sure to have a unique angle on it. And so that's very beneficial with companies like Zachtronics, where it's like, yes, people know that name. It is a household name. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the press coverage that they are getting is meaningful to them. And again, I think that comes back to the whole gigantic influencer pyramid thing. It's like, I can get a mention on Rock, Paper, Shotgun. How far does that actually get me? How does that actually translate in terms of revenue? Something that you mentioned was really interesting to me is that they're publishers of different scale. And it is very much so like, there's not a whole lot in the smaller end of that pool. Like when we have stuff like I can really only think of like Humble Bundle Originals, because if you're trying to ask for any less than like 500K, like good luck. Nobody's going to even talk to you. They're just like, go get an angel investor, get out of here. And I know that like Callum Underwood is doing a lot of great work in that space to get data out there, to more broadly define this stuff, to give people a better idea of like, to stop stabbing in the dark or relying on conference culture to get by, and who to actually start approaching and talking to, and what fair terms even look like, because everyone's too afraid to talk about their sales numbers. They're too afraid to talk about their contract terms and everything else. And if you're just a person in the garage, you can't even tap into the ability to like hire an experienced business dev. Like you're just kind of like, you're screwed. Like, what are you supposed to do? Well, I guess you're going to spend the next 5 to 6 years learning how to be a lawyer and an MBA and like everything else, right?
I have something kind of brewing in my head right now, which is
micro brewing
in my head, which is I've thought a lot about this idea that you've brought up about, you know, the image problem, the indie game as a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I feel like there's this extent to which, you know, you have indie games. Let's say you have like the biggest game you can possibly think of, like a GTA 5 or like a freaking FIFA or something, that like everyone has one of these games if you're a quote gamer. Then like the drop off from there into like hardcore gaming is like, there's a big drop off between that and people who play like even Skyrim, which is like one of the biggest games out, like RPGs out there. There's like a huge drop off. And then there's like multiple other drop offs beneath that, which is like people who like look at the Steam store all the time and are getting like one of the games on there. And then indie is like somewhere far beneath that. You know, it's like a niche within a niche within a niche. And it's interesting to me because a lot of indie games that I've seen over the past decade desperately want to have a lot more broad of an appeal. I think of something like A Short Hike, right? Like one of the games that we played recently, extremely approachable, charismatic game with great writing. Anyone could theoretically play this game. But it still, to me, feels very buried. It feels like if it was something that I was to introduce to just like a kind of random person, they would look at me like what? It would look like it's from a different world, because you have to go to like an itch page and pay what you want. Is like, what is this?
What kind of communist crap is this? Like my capitalist society.
It's why to outsiders I always pitch itch as Bandcamp for games, because people know what Bandcamp is. They just go for it. It's like sometimes those direct parallels work. You know, don't do them in game reviews, but when you're talking about platforms, all the way, like, go for it. Because it helps those broader audiences, like, connect with the concepts like that.
I just wonder if there's, like, an extent to which indie games have their own, like, kind of image problem, or if it's a platform problem. I know that there's been a lot of big movements with how are you pushing these games out. Like, there is a lot of new platforms that have sprouted up in the past, you know, months, years, what have you. Like, even Discord, which we're using to video chat right now, has its own freaking platform for selling games. And I wonder if that's, like, part of the solution is, like, getting indie games into a platform that is, like, you know, packages them up better.
So this is where I think sort of, like, and I know this isn't the appropriate uses of the term, but I haven't found anything better. There are these smaller publishers popping up that while they might not be taking pitches, they are curating. And they kind of do what I like to refer to as, like, you know, in music, this means a different thing, but here, vanity labels, where basically, like, they're just going in, they're doing one thing, and they're doing one thing really well. What comes to mind for that is New Blood. I think New Blood has done so much for the image of indie games with broader audiences by sort of capitalizing on, like, the retro boomer shooter, as a lot of people put it, because Dusk was just great. It's a great game. It's fantastic. It's crafted with love. It's very wholesome. It is very, very indie. Amid Evil, same thing. Slightly larger team, a little bit more commercial experience, but, you know, just super fresh, super interesting. Kind of out there when you think of, like, the pedigree of, like, types of shooters that have come out over the years. And now, you know, they've got some other projects on the burners. It's great. It's not like Devolver, where it's like, we're the people who brought you Hotline Miami and Hotline Miami 2 and question marks.
They really have been cruising on that. I feel like that's, like, what, that's just, like, I mean, they're still, like, when the, like, a game, I think Ton Zero is Devolver, right? Right?
Yeah, they still pump out a ton of shit.
I feel like they pump out a lot. I'm always surprised when I see a Devolver label, because I feel like they're almost like, it feels almost like AAA at this point. They put out so many games. Too.
Doing that crazy, what's, like, the crazy, like, the, oh, fuck, it's like the side scroll with, like, the crazy goopy monster.
I was like, I could hear it in my head because I played that demo and the sound design was gross and amazing. They put out a lot, but yeah, they're always just, you remember Hotline Miami? Like, that's what all their games kind of feel like. Like, they have that same tone to it.
Well, I'm not going to mince words on this. You know, I think there's a lot of great folks at Devolver, but their brand, and they acknowledge this, is very much so, like, we're edgy.
Yeah.
And it's like, we just got in the 90s. Do we really need that? I know it appeals to a certain demographic, and that's fine. I don't think there's any problem with that. And I think that's the thing, is, like, we're shifting from this, like, so who here has watched Adam Curtis movies?
Not me.
Okay, so
I don't think I've watched it.
Adam Curtis is this BBC documentarian, and
Did he do Hypernormalization?
Yes, Hypernormalization. Okay, if you've seen that, you're good. So in part of Hypernormalization, they talk about the sort of, like, Russian propaganda machine. Here I go again with, like, the, like, way outlandish, like, comparisons.
Bring it back.
There's this, like, really not great dude who's, like, kind of like Putin's right-hand man, but he does a lot of, like, weird media theory things for evil, which is really interesting. But there is something he talks about, which is, like, he kind of deals with the different phases of, like, political theory. And one of the things he talks about is how we're not in a unipolar media world when it comes to nation states. You know, each respective country has, like, their truth now. You know, it's not just, here's the neoliberal democracies of the world, you know, pioneering the truth. It's that US has its truth. China has its truth. Russia has its truth that the states push for their respective self-interests. And you can see that now that the media sphere is so decentralized, so disseminated, that's true now for every industry we encounter. And so what I mean to say by this is, like, we have had a very unipolar model of games media for the past, like, 20 to 30 years, where everything was about trade publications. And it was about these like AAA games, and anything that happened outside of that was like an oddity. It was a freak accident. Nobody knows where it came from. Now we exist in this space where everything's gotten flatter. And that's true of information in general these days because of the internet. And so now we're having to kind of embrace this model of like, okay, there's not just like this one absolute truth for everything. We're having to deal with all these different parties that have sort of an equal share in this bigger picture. And so I think that's kind of where things like Devolver fall into. And that's why we're shifting towards a model of like these like boutique publishers. There we go. That's a good term for it. So I know that's like a wild comparison, but it's like you can see these systems like bubbling up and percolating, as you put it, of just like these different models of approaching how we interact with things. Because, you know, for the past 10 years, we've had to deal with like Apple products being so dominant. We've had to deal with like the Marvel Cinematic Universe and Disney owning everything. But because people are so all over the place now, it's like we have streaming services outside of Netflix. And like a lot of people think about Hulu and stuff like that. But what comes to mind for me is Shudder. Shudder's a really interesting case, right? You pay $5 a month and then Shudder, please sponsor me. You pay $5 a month and you get a collection of not just horror films. This is a really interesting thing. They do a lot of thrillers too. So there's a collection of like amazing Yakuza films on there, like crime thrillers, foreign films, all these kinds of stuff that you normally wouldn't get access to. And a company that I think of that built their entire model off of that was Criterion Collection, right? So if I remember their history right, Criterion started off as a company that did like educational CD software. Like they'd make these CDs.
No, so
Criterion
used to be into HyperCard stuff. And basically there was two people. And then one of them was like, I'm going to do this DVD thing. And the other guy was like, nah,
yeah,
the DVD thing's nothing. And then they left. The old Criterion company was basically publishing, I think, like kind of crazy HyperCard games.
Yeah. And specifically they would do things like, here's the HyperCard stacks all relating to Mozart. And so you can learn things about the structure of the Fifth Symphony, everything like that, which when you think about it, isn't too alien to today. We have YouTube channels that specialize in the finite detail of that stuff now. Then they got in the redistribution game. So they were going and taking foreign films from markets that didn't have any distribution in the US and just going like, fuck it, here it goes. It kind of organically, I'm sorry, is swearing okay on this podcast?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Oh, yes. We have the explicit tag on iTunes.
Great,
for a reason.
Great. Because I am like a sailor. So Criterion organically evolved into this image, this brand of a curative critical presence, even though they don't have that at all. Like they just wanted to redistribute things they thought were cool. And I think that is a very strong model to proceed in the future when it comes to games, especially indies. And because you can't rely on like eventually new blood will hit a wall like any other company where it's like it's the same problem that happened to Devolver, right? Devolver became too known for a certain thing that they probably didn't define too well. So I know that like they're known for Hotline Miami and then blank, you know, most people can't answer the other things that they're known for. They know their shtick, they know their brand, but it doesn't bring to mind certain types of titles. New blood is probably going to have to spend the next couple of years diversifying their portfolio and presenting themselves as not just a company that does just boomer shooters, right? So what we kind of run into here is that we're either going to have these hyper-specialized labels or we're going to have labels that are smaller but have a more diverse scope of portfolio. But I think that's the way for the future, a lot of people, especially as Steam moves to this like sort of like curative model as well with in terms of like a lot of people complain about the Steam front page and recommendations and the machine learning algorithms that they have in place. But what they don't realize is like Valve has put in a lot of work behind the scenes to make that curative stuff really align better when you start following a few curators. Like the second I followed like two just random curators, suddenly my feed of games started making a lot more sense for me. So, and I think that's a difficult thing because, again, we're used to that unipolar media model where it's like, I go to the Steam front page and it's going to show me what's cool right now. Right. And now
it's like you're walking up to like a glass display at like Urban Outfitters and you're like, what's the hip skirt right now?
Yeah. People want
that's
that.
That's the
like,
one.
People want that like easy answer. Right. And I think they want it also as sellers because sellers don't want to waste their time with big marketing campaigns that don't go anywhere. They want to know like what's going to get me the maximum results because it's a matter of survival for them. And so I think we're in this really rough transitionary period right now where everyone's just getting brutalized on like the sales numbers and everything else as we move towards this new model. And I think that's making people feel really distraught and feel really aimless and not sure where to go next.
I mean, I think a lot about, it's like, what's it called? I think I'm going to sound like a fucking old ass person. It was like net labels, right? Like 5 years ago.
Oh yeah. It was like, yeah. That was it was like online record labels, but not really. Most time they had their music up for free. Yeah. I wrote a big article on that. Like
I think I learned about it because of your article. Yeah. Oh, but it was so like, there's basically net labels that were like signing, like quote unquote signing, basically their friends and other people who made music that sounded a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember the guy's fucking name now, but I think like the big one was like PC Music.
Oh, PC Music got right? start as a net label thing, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Ago, and that yeah, guy yeah. who founded PC Music is now like the manager for Charlie XCX.
Oh, really?
So
weird.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I guess that makes sense.
My point,
that's like a similar.
But so that's kind of my point, though, is that like it might be actually the thrust of a lot of these smaller kind of like micro publishers, unless they like want to become this sort of like massive known entity. What they're actually aiming for is just to be actually become so big that they just get disseminated into the rest of culture. It's like something like I forget their name. You just said them, Emily. The people who published The Medieval and Dusk.
New Blood.
What's their name? Yeah, New Blood. It's like New Blood exists now as sort of an umbrella that like niche stuff can exist inside of.
Mm-hmm.
But once they kind of like poke out of that, all of a sudden New Blood is like everywhere. And that's like maybe the actual success. They don't, because once like Boomer Shooters are like top sellers on Steam, it doesn't actually matter that New Blood has to exist anymore because in some ways their goals have been achieved where they've like kind of ushered in this type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's the benefit of them is that they can basically incubate, disseminate, and then evaporate. I just came up with that. And then a new one starts to incubate some new like thing. And I think
and
that
the
other model
rain
is like,
cloud where all this evaporation has gone.
Yeah, exactly. It's just kind
money.
Of like moving around. It's like little genre bubbles pop
well,
up to like let stuff
have,
into the water.
Arcane Kids.
Mm-hmm.
Sock Pop.
Yeah. Yeah. What? Man.
So,
I mean, on the subject of Sock Pop, like I feel like something we also haven't really talked about is like Patreon being a new thing or a thing this decade for helping smaller
yeah.
developers remain like sustainable. Like there's like Puppet Combo. I'm trying to think of like other developers that are like fairly successful on Patreon. Like Sock Pop, I think just hit their 50th game milestone, which is fucking mm-hmm. crazy.
My God.
Puppet Combo is a machine. I'm going to give him
yeah.
that. Like that
yeah.
that dude just
I don't know.
They,
it's just like
out.
Constant, like so much. And they're all so unique.
It's like, did you just put a game out?
Yeah. Like,
what the hell?
Like Sock Pops are all in the same art style, but like Puppet Combo, like I don't understand. And these are all substantial games too. They're not like little one-off things.
Here's what's fascinating about Puppet Combo. He comes from outside the games industry. You know, he didn't even play games, whatever. He just like one day just decided, I'm just going to make games. Cool. And what I find fascinating about that is the most incredible games I've seen this decade and creative projects have come from people of different backgrounds, sometimes not even artistic ones. And so if I were to spy a trend for the future, we're going to start seeing a lot of people from other industries come into games and be kind of a big deal. Like if you want to be making cutting edge games, be it art house or otherwise, start talking to playwrights, start talking to people who have existed in the performance art space, because there is so much to pull on. There's such a rich history. There's so many different like movements that have gone hand in hand with like philosophy and other big cultural landmarks that, I mean, I'm going to be real. A lot of our analysis is really inspired by and looks up to like a lot of postmodernist movements, especially like French phenomenology. And that kind of all ties back in with like, you know, Beckett and Artaud, I can't remember his name, and like the theater of the absurd, the theater of cruelty, so on and so forth. And that's going to be a big tectonic shift, I think, for games, especially art games, but like even beyond that. And we're starting to see that come true with a game that's a big deal for me this decade is Control. Because Sam Lake has always kind of had a knack for being tapped into like the literary circles and like really broad inspirations. And I know the moment I picked up Control and opened it up, I'm like, this is just like a J.G. Ballard book. You know, this is very mm-hmm. much so like evoking like High Rise, the Crystal World and things like that, which kind of had a resurgence in popularity thanks to stuff like the
High Rise, the movie,
High Rise, the movie, but specifically Annihilation. Because the new weird, you know, Jeff Vandermeer and all that stuff has been sort of like this weird micro genre that spawned out of stuff like Ballard's really like ambiguous and like vaguely defined works with the surrealist touch to them. So what was interesting about Control as well was the way that the dialogue was structured. And I don't know if this was intentional or not, because I haven't had a chance to sit down and talk with Sam Lake. But there is this vibe that I get from it and like the pace of the dialogue, the very like stilted nature of it. It's very intentional and it does evoke the same stylings that Ballard employed with his dialogue and his works. So I think that's going to have a lot of fascinating impacts as like people branch out, because the problem in the past like 10 years up until this point has been that video games only pull on video games. You know, it's like someone trying to make Deus Ex 20 times over, and it's like eventually you go like, okay, we've milked it for all it's got, you know, imagine if film just sat around trying to make Citizen Kane for like 50 years. Like, it would get really boring really fast.
Well, I think it's even if you look at the kind of start of video games stuff in general, like you read interviews with like a lot of the kind of original people who made games for PC, like a lot of them were pulling from D&D, but like you read like how Sid Meier came up with Civilization. He was like a fucking history nerd who had a book that had like a big picture in it that like looked like the history of the world. And he was like, I want to make a game that's like that. And it wasn't like he didn't grow up playing Civilization and want to make another Civilization. Mm-hmm. It's that he was like all these, he was like had all of his reference points were like not games. And so I think you're right. It's that there was kind of this first wave of people who didn't know anything about games because they didn't really exist, make games. And then now that we're living in an era where it's like, I grew up playing Mario and I want to make my 2D platformer, which is fine. You can get some good shit there. But then I think what you're talking about is interesting, is you're gonna have all these people who are coming from other industries, especially as like game creation gets more accessible, mm-hmm. are going to say, I want to make a game like this Beckett play. And like, even if that Beckett play is like the most like rote, boring, like high school bullshit, like that will be a revolutionary idea in games. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden, a lot of stuff, I mean, this is the hope, right? Is that like a lot of stuff will start coming out that feels like it's pulling from these different places. And like what we assume is kind of the default in a game is not necessarily going to be the default for people that have these reference points. Like, it's obviously clear that the person who made Control, whether or not they're inspired by Ballard or whatever, like you're still willing to gun and run around third person shooting stuff. Like that is a video game ass video game thing. Mm-hmm. And that won't just be the default for people who are coming from another area.
Yeah, it's like, I think even AAA benefits from being well-read and coming from different sources and thinking about different things. Because as games increase in complexity, it's like, even though it has slowly gained momentum, I feel like the player base has grown a taste for wanting to expand the narrative scope of these games. You know, we've gone from Doom where it's just like, you're a space marine who punches, to like stuff like Watch Dogs where it's like really complex sociological, like, you know, sociocultural like analysis stuff, talking about like things like Amazon. And, you know, it's like you can see a lot of things that Watch Dogs was talking about a couple of years ago that are finally coming to pass now in terms of like, and I don't think they were being prophetic or anything. It's just like, it's not hard to predict something like smart doorbells.
It's like they just looked out of their window instead of like looking at a video game.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that stuff isn't hard to predict, but, I think it is hard to take risks on. And I'm glad that AAA is kind of expanding those boundaries. It's like, say what you will about it, but Far Cry 5 laid a lot of groundwork in terms of like Ubisoft poured a lot of money into research in that game for the narrative and to like going out and flying out to Montana and talking to people and getting a feel for these things, which is something that we sort of had a gap in this industry for a while. But I think that precedent was probably initially set by companies like Valve, because I know that Valve did like a lot of research on the environments for Half-Life 2. But it's also kind of like sort of the idea that like you look at certain settings in like Half-Life 2 and stuff like that, or even like Left 4 Dead, and you can go in the Pacific Northwest and find something and be like, wait a minute, that's just this beach. And you just took it from like a place, like you copy pasted a real world location, which is totally cool and fine. But I guess something that's worth noting is that like, we do have a tendency to overthink video games sometimes. And I can't think of a better example than like Spec Ops: The Line, right? You know, people assign so much value artistically to like, wow, this guy must have really sat there and did a lot of thinking about the setting. And like, I think if you read interviews with him, he's pretty much just like, no, I just pulled some stuff out of my ass. You know, I just liked Heart of Darkness, whatever. Like, it's not that big of a deal. Like, I didn't think too hard about it. I just wrote it.
I'm trying to think of anything else to say about the decade in indies, but I feel like we covered a crazy amount of ground.
Mm-hmm. I think so, too.
I think there's something worth talking about, which is Death Stranding. As annoying as some people, I think, are going to find that. Because I think there's discourse.
I mean, talk about, like, an indie game, right? It's like, I mean, I don't... That's kind of like the first and last word.
I did think about what you were saying though earlier about like reaching outside of the video game sphere, and it seems like Kojima did that to a large extent with this game, where it was like he was off the leash, man. He could do whatever he wanted,
unchained,
and he just reached out to all these directors. You've got Guillermo in there, you've got Refn in there, as you mentioned. You've got all these actors, actresses who are like huge. And they're kind of like doing their own thing, and it feels like they have a part to play in this passion project, and that they're open to it because it's like, it's this, you know, auteur who's doing this thing in the video game space, who has this vision, and they want to be a part of it, even if some of it is a little sus. Like,
there's something really interesting in Death Stranding I haven't seen people talk about very much, which is that, rather than have unlockable concept art and things like that, as you progress through the game, you unlock this sort of like, it's almost like a Pinterest like mood board thing. Yeah. And if you click these different things, like he talks about like, oh, this enemy in the game was directly inspired by this movie I saw as a kid. Or like, this is why I chose these songs for the games. I just bumbled into a record store or whatever. And I think that's really fascinating and something we haven't seen in the industry very much up to this point. And I think that's why kind of Death Stranding is special. And even though it's like very like AAA seeming, it's like it's a pretty nonviolent game. Like, it takes you a long time to actually even get into combat in that game. You spend most of your time just like trying not to fall over, which is kind of incredible for something that has had that much money pumped into it and has that much reach in terms of marketing and distribution. And I think that's really helpful to indies. Because again, it acclimatizes that broader market to be more receptive of those ideas that are very experimental, and to pull them out of like the like, hey, we're gonna do the same thing for 20 years like idea. Because again, people after doing that for 20 years come to expect a certain thing. So it's this very like slow building of momentum. And when you have something like Death Stranding happen, it opens up huge doors for people being able to charge a lot of money for really weird things.
Yep. Anything else that we want to cover before we wrap things up? Maybe what about the next 10 years? What are your hopes?
Oh, that's a good one.
Wishes. What do you think will happen? What should happen?
Micro indies being able to actually charge livable prices, like to actually pay themselves a living wage. I think that is a moral imperative for the industry at this point. And that takes artists valuing themselves more, and that takes new distribution models popping up. And I think the most apocalyptic thing that could happen in the industry in the next 10 years is for to have the dominance of like Game Passes and streaming stuff and like the Spotify model take over, because that will entrench AAA, because they'll be the only ones who'll be able to keep up. I'm pretty optimistic that that won't happen, but I do recognize that it is a pretty like prescient moral hazard that has been constructed over the past few years. And so I'm kind of thankful that Stadia is a flop.
I don't think those deals are equitable either. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think that the people who made Void Bastards get paid the same amount for exclusivity and subscription models as like Paradox or Imperator Rome. Mm-hmm. So it's not even that like, oh, they're all together in the subscription pass. I'm like, I mean, this is like, I feel like the biggest like shame of our industry right now is that no one is talking about how much these deals are actually worth, besides the one that actually slipped for Control on the exclusivity thing. But like no one is saying, even like nothing is always even leaking how much these deals are actually worth for people. So it's all just like total speculation. Because I think I agree with you too. I also think that like what's going to happen as well is that like, I think what is fucking crazy to me, honestly, is that like the price of a video game has not gone up in terms of sticker price in like 20 years. Like AAA games should be $120, but instead they're recouping that value through like DLC and kind of expansion pass stuff.
It's got to come out of something.
It's got to come somewhere. And what it's doing is undercutting like developer trust. It's undercutting people's like perception of value of like how much things are worth.
And it's warping artistic content. You know, it's changing the content to shape the economic models.
It's shifting everything.
You know, imagine if we got movies in like little chunks, it would just be like,
it wouldn't make sense. But it's like, that's going to get really high. So I feel like what will happen is that AAA will, if you're not in a subscription service, it's going to go up. Like next Call of Duty, maybe not the next one, but the one after that's going to cost like $80 to $100. That's my hope.
Call of Duty is an interesting.
It's going to do that. It's going to incentivize you to go to a pass model because you don't want to spend that much money because it feels like a lot more money. But then what that's going to do is it's going to create a vacuum where if AAA costs $80 to $90, a micro indie can charge $20 and it's like, that's fucking pennies. That's nothing. When in fact, like, I think that micro indies have been suffering because if Call of Duty comes out and is charging itself for $60, the idea that like a micro indie is a third as much value as Call of Duty is like, yeah, that's fucking insane. Of course that's not true. It's because Call of Duty actually costs $180. You're just going to amortize the cost over like 2 years for that game. So I think it's like that both those things are going to happen where it's like games are going to get more expensive. It's going to incentivize Game Pass models, but also it might actually create a space that micro indies can charge like a livable wage in, hopefully.
And not only that, but people had really big complaints about like, where'd all my single player games go with cool stories? And it's like, they went indie because the big boys are like AAA multiplayer, like 24/7 always on loot box extravaganzas.
Yep. Yeah. Platforms. Whew, this was, we covered a lot of ground. And thank you for that, Emily. This has been amazing.
Of course.
Yeah, it's really great to have you on. Finally.
Like, really all I could have ever asked for. Why don't you...
Do you mind if I like plug a few games that I think are like...
Oh, you should plug. Please, yeah, just plug it all.
Plug everything that you want to plug.
I feel bad because the first half of this decade for indie stuff has been kind of a blur for me. So I'm going to focus in the past few years. But I think games that people should check out if they're kind of looking to get a better grounding idea of the things that we're talking about is... Nate Baron's Sagebrush, any of Christoph Frey's games, but specifically The Space Between, because you want to talk about art house indie, that is like pinnacle for me. I think Oleander Gardens did a really good job with their Pagan series entirely, but you can drop right into Pagan 3 Autogeny, and that game is just phenomenal. It's like this weird like art house like dot hack thing going on. So if you're really into the idea of like abandoned MMORPGs and like that sort of narrative, like absolutely do that. Like if there's anyone listening that played like No Players Online and really enjoyed like the hauntology of that, go play Autogeny. It's superb and really just like I think when it comes to AA stuff like Control and Death Stranding, fantastic. Just there have been some great games this decade, but those really jump out at me as being like iconic and really innovative.
You could plug Paratopic too. It's okay.
Yeah, I'd say Paratopic as well. I know definitely that Paratopic has been like very much so informed by the things I was talking about in terms of like performance art and philosophy and stuff like that. And then I guess like what I'd rather plug is, and I'm kind of biased because Mixmedia, our editor, was the narrative designer and writer for it, but their next game, Arbitrary Metric's next game, Roman Sands, definitely draws on like Waiting for Godot and a bunch of other stuff. Yeah, so I know that's available through Humble Originals. I don't know what it's going to be available on after that, but that's where people can find it now. Yeah, it's there's some really good stuff. I mean, just explore, just get out there, check out tags, and please play games by like minorities because of the fact that they come from so many different like walks of life and backgrounds. You'll wind up with a richer library for it, you know? And that's I think like all I've got to say in terms of like, it's really hard for me to just think of like, what's the most important games of the decade? And it's like, you're going to have 20 lists where people are like, Papers, Please. And it's just like, all right, you know, just try to like play stuff you haven't heard of.
Mm-hmm. Can you also, earlier, I know we're like, if you're just plugging stuff right now, you mentioned like a few other kind of places to read about indie stuff, and it was things that I haven't also heard of. Mm-hmm. If you could like list out, obviously your Rebind, but you mentioned a few other blogs that are kind of like good places to check out for more stuff that like is like what you guys cover.
I will say before I plug those individual sites that the people over at Critical Distance have been doing an incredible job for like over a decade in terms of rounding up those outlets and sites, because it's kind of always changing. People move on, they get jobs, they switch industries, whatever. But if you always want to keep up to date with like what's in vogue and who really is doing the best writing, bar none, like Crit Distance is the most amazing place. I especially recommend it for academics because they have some sort of like embedded archival stuff that like helps to like retain that for historical value. Outlets that come to mind is DeepHell, Capsule Crit, No Escape VG. Again, for video essayists, Umbrella Terms, Errant Signal is a big one that everyone knows, Soft and Hollow, and there's a couple of other smaller ones I've been keeping track up of a little bit. I don't know them personally, and I can't like super endorse them because I haven't followed a ton of their content, but I really enjoy Thor High Heels does some really like deep dive stuff, especially in older franchises like Silent Hill and things like that, and goes into kind of the background. Like I think they did an entire video on like the whole rationale and design of like Akira Yamaoka's sound direction on the Silent Hill franchise, which was like super fascinating. YouTube is really killing it in terms of like really good, like critical analysis stuff too. So there's a lot of options beyond like written word. And I mean, like for what it's worth, I think that the one outlet to really carry the torch for a long time has probably been Giant Bomb, you know? I don't always agree with the articles on there but they have like a good, healthy, robust understanding of video games, I feel like. And I think they have enough of a cynical outlook to kind of like see through the BS on a lot of stuff. And they just like covering what they like covering and talking about what they want to talk about. So that's always been a good outlet that's worth checking once in a while. So.
Cool. And then why don't you plug your own stuff before we log out here?
Yeah. So again, Rebind.io, the best place to engage with us is actually on Twitter. Whenever we post an article, it's like right up on Twitter, and that's kind of like where we actually track our metrics. I mean, you can go directly to the site. We try to do Monday through Friday as much as we can. So, you know, the idea is like, I remember refreshing Rock, Paper, Shotgun every day. So we go for kind of the same thing. I feel like people enjoy that kind of like stability of the cycling content, but, Twitter is the best place to like get news and updates on that. I'm hoping we'll launch a podcast either like probably like start of next year. We'll see. It depends on Patreon. So, you know, please subscribe to us because we are totally reliant on our readership. We want to keep the site ad free, and We're also very easy to read in terms of like, we put a lot of work into the design of our site. It's very like web 2.0, like just, you know, text, lots of text, a couple of images, because we want it to be as sort of like frictionless as possible for people to engage with. So
great.
I think we're one of the only sites that I've heard people talk about going through the backlog of. It's like people who come across this, they'll go to like our first article and work their way up to the present. And I'm like, that's dedication. I'm astounded anyone wants to read my words that badly, but that's it's really nice. And you can find me on Twitter at Caravan Malice, just like Caravan Palace. And there's Catherine, who's Catherine Briniger, our other writer, videographer. Mix Medea, who's our editor. And yeah.
Okay, Emily. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been...
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
You've been... This has been great. This has been seriously a lot of fun. We are Bad End Podcast. Again, this is episode 62. We are a super culture podcast. I can now say that. It's cool. you can find us on Twitter at Bad End Podcast. You can also email us at badendpod@gmail.com. Rate us and review us on iTunes, and go check out Super Culture Review Disco Elysium podcast called Savoir Faire. And go check out Bullet Points, because they are our partner site as well. We're all under one umbrella now. So we all live in the same space. Emily, again, thank you so much, and we'll see everyone in a couple weeks. Later.
Yeah.